This is actually a Grand Sonnerie Tiffany carriage clock. So you can have it strike just the hours, the quarters, or you can have it be on silent.
Let's just take a second. Could you just introduce yourself before we go any further?
Sure. Hi, I'm Brittany Nicole Cox. I'm a clock and watchmaker located in Seattle, Washington. I specialize in complicated musical clocks, watches, automata, and kind of anything that's fun and fancy like that.
And I'm Gabriel Spitzer. I specialize in hosting sound effect from KPLU. So let's take a closer look at this thing. It's about the size of like a light switch box or something.
Yeah, I'd say it's about the size of a light switch you'd find on your wall.
What does it look like? How would you describe that to somebody who doesn't know the ins and outs of the inside of a clock?
There's no way to really explain how many layers are happening. Basically, it's a clock mechanism, so it's run on springs. It could actually fit in the palm of your hand. Inside is a series of wheels that make up two trains. One of them operates the striking, and the other one operates the time. And on the front, you have all of the work that dictates what time and also when the hours are going to be struck, and if you want to set that and have it strike the hours on command.
Does it make noise?
Yes.
Can we hear it?
Well, I don't think I have it wound, actually. I can wind it up. That's actually why it's here. It's not supposed to sound like that. It should just be the hours, ding, ding, and then your quarters. So the fact that it's ringing out a few things afterwards, that's a problem.
Okay, so what is it about this box and the workings of it that has a richness for you?
I love puzzles and riddles and things like that, and this is a way of, you know, looking and solving puzzles and riddles. I get to work with tangible things that have a lot of heritage and offer a lot in way of cultural history and incredible craftsmanship.
Well, the ticking clock is what's on our mind today on Sound Effect from KPLU. We'll have tales of time, the turning of the gears, and the approaching of deadlines, among other things, as well as a lot more from Brittany Cox. That's all ahead on Sound Effect from KPLU, so don't go away. We're going to start off with a story about time running out on a particular technology and a particular craft. And it has to do with the way that film is edited, you know, when you're using actual film. So here's how that's always worked. You have an editor who's chopping it together, you know, he or she is making cuts and saying, put a fade here and putting the scenes all in the right order. But that is really just like a blueprint. The actual final cut of the movies that we know and love is usually done by somebody known as a professional tape cutter. Somebody like Andy Pratt. He's worked on a lot of projects over his career, including a few you may have heard of.
The Star Wars set of movies.
Why, you stuck-up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder!
Who's scruffy-looking?
The Raiders of the Lost Ark trilogy.
I came here to save you! Oh, yeah? And who's gonna come to save you, Junior? I told you!
Don't call me Junior.
The alien shows.
I say we take off and nuke the entire site from orbit. It's the only way to be sure.
All total, it's been about 700 movies that I've worked on.
Andy Pratt is the vice president of Deluxe Archive Solutions in the Georgetown neighborhood of Seattle. It's one of the very last big negative cutting houses left in the country. And, of course, as everything goes digital, there's less need for people skilled in cutting actual film negatives with actual scissors. Most of what he does these days is work with shows and films that were edited digitally in the 90s, but now those aren't up to snuff for viewing on today's giant TV sets. So he uses the original negatives to painstakingly recreate them frame by frame. So I met Andy Pratt at Deluxe, and he showed me their cavernous warehouse.
We're probably looking at something in excess of 100 million feet of film.
This is, I mean, it's hard to get the scale across. I mean, this It looks like the bottom floor of IKEA. I mean, it's shelf after shelf after shelf of box after box after box.
The ceiling is 26 feet high, and each pallet has, on average, about 30 boxes. It just adds up.
For now, the film business needs somebody like Andy who knows how to handle all this film. But the clock is ticking on this industry, and Andy knows it. In a room upstairs, there are all these serious-looking technicians. They're working busily at stand-up desks, turning spindles and watching monitors and making very precise cuts. And Andy, explain to me what it's like to work like that in a craft that he knows doesn't have much time left.
Originally, all of the post-production, negative cutting that was done was down in Hollywood for the most part. When I first moved up here away from Hollywood, those were the things that I focused on. And the irony now is that there's not a negative cutter left in Hollywood. They're all gone, and we're now the biggest and I think the only negative cutting facility left in the world. There might be some over in India, but I'm not sure.
The only one in the world, probably?
To my knowledge, because almost all of the laboratories are gone. So there's no or very little film being shot anymore. And then combined with that, there's no one's finishing on film. Even if you shot a movie on film today, you would immediately scan it and work on it in a digital format rather than in a physical format.
So that being the case, do you see yourself as a kind of keeper of the flame? Are you keeping something alive?
Well, only to the extent that it's a sunset industry and we'll eventually have to move on to other stuff. You know, there's only so much film out there, and now that they've stopped creating it, there will be a time frame when this all goes away.
So what's that like to be so devoted to something and having spent a whole career investing in your skills and knowledge base and appreciation for this craft that you know is going to go away?
Well, I would say it's pretty much like the buggy maker, the steamship maker. You know, there's a time frame for everything, and this is just another example of that.
So how does it feel to be a buggy maker in the dawn of the automobile?
Well, we still make good buggies. The one truth in all of this, digital is not an archival medium. It's a medium that allows for easy access, a medium that allows for easy manipulation. But as far as actually being an archive, it's a joke. It could fail tomorrow or it could fail in 5 or 6 years, but it'll certainly fail before the 20-year mark.
So what changed? What made you climb down off the soapbox and stop railing against change?
The reality that I wasn't going to stop it. You know, you live in a world of convenience, and for a long time, film was convenient to use. I mean, I myself don't shoot. I bet you I've shot one roll of still film in the last 2 years or 3 years.
Do you think we lose something in the transition, even if you're at peace with it? Are we losing something?
Well, there's the potential in any change, and this one is, I would say, it maybe is more critical based on the fact that it's a piece of actual history to the extent that it goes beyond a singular unit. It's not like the buggy maker who made the buggy and they don't make it anymore. When film is created and is utilized in a certain way, it creates a history and a time frame of that history that can be shared into the future. The problem that's occurring now is that a lot of the material in the transition between the film and the digital, the early digital material, we've already started losing some of that. And in losing it, we're losing a piece of our history. So that is an unfortunate ramification of what's transpired.
And what's at stake? Like, why should ordinary folks care about preserving all of that stuff?
Again, it's history. So, you know, consider all of the TV stations, cable channels that provide information about historical events and utilize old film and old video to create that overall product. You're in a situation, and this goes from a very small organization to a very large organization. Someone that's interested in automobiles, someone that's interested in the history of some specific small group that either still exists or did exist at one time and no longer does, but there was film or video that was created around that. If that material is eventually destroyed or decays, then you're in a situation where you don't have that relationship, that background that you can utilize going forward. So it's a loss, and you know, no one wants to be the cause for that, I guess. You know, we want to try and maintain as much history as possible. What's the old saw, you know, people who forget history are doomed to repeat it. So, you know, by creating all of this and perpetuating it, we hope that we won't go down the same path.
Well, Andy Pratt is at the helm of Deluxe Archive Solutions, based here in the Georgetown neighborhood of Seattle, with another location in Burbank, California. Thank you so much for showing us around.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week we are homing in on the ticking clock. Not so long ago, before there were self-driving cars and microprocessors, or even combustion engines and easily accessible electricity, the state-of-the-art technology was clockwork. Through cams and springs and gears, craftsmen were able to create really precise tools and rudimentary robots and exquisite pieces of art. Brittany Nicole Cox is one of just a handful of antiquarian horologists. Those are people who are trained to preserve and restore these objects, like this 18th century French music box you're hearing right now. She does that from her workshop in Seattle's Columbia City neighborhood. She wears gloves and a white lab coat, and she takes out an object that's sort of Brittany's specialty within a specialty, a Victorian-era automaton.
This is a singing bird cage. Basically, it's a mechanical bird that is powered by a spring. It has a train and some very particular shaped cams that dictate the motions of the bird. It has bellows for its lungs and a slide whistle that is its voice.
The bird itself is about the size of probably my index finger, and it's on a perch that sits on a box that also contains all of the workings inside. What era does this date from?
This is going to be late 1800s.
How did you get into this?
That's a really good question. It's a long answer. I kind of got into it because it was something that when I was a child, I envisioned things like this, but didn't know that these were actual things that existed.
Wait, things like what?
Like automata. I loved music boxes and watches when I was small, and I thought when I got older, it would be amazing to make things or see things that were mechanical like that, but were like animals, because my other favorite thing was animals when I was a kid. And still, that's still true, which is why I love these so much. But basically, I went in to do, I was a jeweler for many years and did studies in philosophy, and I leaned towards metaphysics and epistemology, which is the theory of knowledge and possibility.
How did a philosophy degree lead you into singing birds and repeating watches and things like that?
Because it was specifically that I was really interested in this Renaissance period when people were basically trying to simulate what God can do, you know, how to make life. My favorite object of all time is the silver swan. And that's a magnificent sterling silver swan that has three clock mechanisms inside and a carillon of bells. And the swan is absolutely lifelike. It sits on a bed of twisted glass rods that contra-rotate so they look like water. And then there are these little gold and silver fish that swim up and down. And the swan is preening its feathers. It turns around and its neck goes down and looks around and actually spies a fish. And then a little fish pops out and it eats it, gobbles it up. There's nothing like it. That's the only one that anyone has ever seen.
Wow.
That, to me, was everything I could have ever hoped for. And so really, I had no choice from there. I had to move forward with pursuing working with and being with these incredible objects.
So when it all clicks, literally, how does that feel?
When it starts working for the first time, that's the best feeling I think anybody could ever experience. It's like knowing that something has sat silent for, 50 years or even longer maybe, and then to have the privilege of hearing it sing once again, I mean, for you, is just, it's phenomenal.
How does that thing work?
So it's got a spring. You wind up the spring, which is located inside of a barrel, and that's basically a large gear. There's a gear situated on the bottom of the barrel, and it also carries the cams, which dictate the motion of the bird as well as the whistle, the way that the whistle is going to be articulated. And then the bellows are the lungs of the bird. So these bellows are being pumped by that spring. This whistle is moving by the spring. And the bird is moving as well. It's all operated via that spring that's located in the barrel.
What do you think this stuff does for somebody that a fancy electronic thing doesn't do?
For me, anyway, it offers this mystery, knowing that it's something antiquated. It's something that's completely self-contained and spring-driven. You know that there are gears and wheels in there. And it's really more tangible, but there's still so much magic to it. With something like an electronic device, there's so much going on that you can't see. It's just not a physical thing. You can take apart and look at every little piece. There's a lot of programming and whatnot that goes into electronics.
And you can wrap your brain around it in a way you can't wrap your brain around opening up a iPhone or something.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's a lot more accessible to people.
Is part of all of this about keeping something from being lost?
Absolutely. It's a way of keeping this alive and preserving that for future generations so that they can understand and see that there was this magic, that existed, that was tangible and physical and very real.
You've used the word magic a bunch of times, both to talk about the wonder of these intricate mechanical devices. And that's something that you are kind of into, right?
Oh, absolutely. I love magic. Magic is the best. It's wonderful to be fooled. If I had one thing to ask for when I die, I want to be delighted by a magician. I know that sounds ridiculous, but it's just so wonderful.
And so you love to be fooled. Why?
The world has got so many wonderful, but also so many sad things. And for me, I'm definitely someone who takes all that very seriously. And there's nothing better than to just feel like everything is wonderful, just for a few seconds, a few minutes, whatever. It's great.
And is it the same feeling you get when all the gears and catches drop into place and something works?
When you see it work for the first time, yeah, absolutely. It's the exact same feeling.
As you're trying to preserve, you're trying to stop the clock in some weird way, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, that's very true. Stop the clock or, manage time. But I think, can you really manage time? It's going to pass by. That's the wonderful and horrible thing about it. Everything passes with time. So,
is there something existential about that for you?
Absolutely. If you want to talk about existential crisis, sometimes for someone like me, I honestly really hate thinking about death and dying. So to be in a business where that's my trade is, dealing with things where I know time is passing by and even preserving things that will live on. For example, I worked on a singing bird that was a scarlet tanager. It was literally a scarlet tanager bird that had been taxidermied and its insides were replaced with clockwork. So, it was a singing bird and alive in some way, but it's interesting to think that that bird outlived all its counterparts.
So as somebody who's carrying on a tradition and preserving these antique objects and technologies for people in the future to what? Appreciate, care about, experience? Like, what do you want them to take away from them?
There's so much magic, and I hope that people will learn how things work, how gear loops work, how pendulums work, how springs work.
But wait, why? Like, is that stuff still relevant?
Absolutely. Absolutely relevant. You know, you can't just move towards the future without learning anything from your past. Otherwise, you'll continue to make the same mistakes. You know, horology is responsible for longitude. We were able to calculate longitude at sea because of a horologist who invented a timepiece that was seaworthy, the first chronometer, basically. Thank you for sending the rocket to the moon, horology, because that mechanism was invented by Charles Sauter, who worked for the Bulova Watchmaking Company. So thank you, Charles Sauter, for that. There's so many things that we have horology to be, you know, to thank horology for.
Including that singing bird.
It's true. Including all things that are magic like that.
Well, Brittany Nicole Cox is an antiquarian horologist. She's got a blog and a website that we will link to from our site, kplusoundeffect.org. You can also go there to find all kinds of amazing photographs of the objects that she works on and the tools she uses to work on them. Brittany, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's Sound Effect on KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here as we zoom in on the ticking clock this week. As we heard a bit just now, there's something kind of awesome and terrible about the ticking clock. The passage of time feels so inexorable and cosmic and way out of our control. But what if we could control time? Even travel through time? That is a question that's preoccupied humans for ages. And it preoccupies a young filmmaker based in Bellevue named Gisela Bustillos. She's finishing up a documentary called A Brief History of Time Travel that examines our obsession with time travel over the course of human history. And in the movie, she talks with scientists and artists and philosophers, and over she asks people this one particular question. So we thought we'd take the baton and ask that same question to some strangers out in Seattle one afternoon.
If you had a time machine of your own, where would you go and when and why?
I think I'd go back to Tudor England because I have a great interest in that history. And I thought the costumes were fabulous and everything about it, the music was fabulous. And I think that's where I'd go.
I'd travel back to probably when I was a kid so I could be with my grandparents again and spend some time with them. I grew up without a mom and dad and they took me in and so I'd like to see them again.
I'll travel back to the beginning just to see where everything all started.
The very beginning?
The very beginning.
What would you want to... Well, that'd be hard.
Yes, it would be hard, but I would like to see the true essence of life really being developed.
Medieval times.
Ah, okay. What would you like to see in medieval times?
Knights and kings and stuff like that, yeah.
So you wouldn't want to go to the future?
Maybe I would want to go to the future and then back to the medieval times. Because I would probably want to get a hoverboard before I go.
When would I travel? When? Right today, man. And why? Because I got some time off of work now.
But when would you travel to? If you had, what time would you go to? Future or past?
I'd like to go back.
I'd like to go back.
Yeah, back in the cowboy days.
Cowboy days, how come?
Seemed like life was tough, but it was simpler, you know, it was more real.
No, it was hard work. It was hard work to survive, but it was work ethic. I actually think I'm from those days. I think I'm reincarnated.
Okay, Gisela, it's your turn now. If you had a time machine, when would you travel to and why?
I would travel 100 years into the future because I want to know what's going on in the future, but it's just enough time that it's not like I'm totally overwhelmed and I wouldn't understand what's happening.
I see. So you think you'd sort of be able to recognize things, but not, but it'd still be different enough to be fascinating.
Yes. I've always been interested in technology and sci-fi. So I'd be really interested in like what the future holds with like virtual reality and augmented reality.
Got it. Okay. So what awakened the interest in time travel in you?
So when I went to film school, I got to watch this film called La Jetée. It's a film by Chris Marker, but 1964. And it brought up all these ideas of, you know, memory and time. And I just fell in love with it. And, you know, I got really interested in the idea of time travel. And I figured what better way to learn more about a topic than do a documentary on it. And it just kind of snowballed from there.
And what was it about time travel in particular that captivated you?
You know, I think the more I started getting into the topic of time travel, I realized how much of a personal thing it is. Like, everybody thinks about traveling through time. Like, everyone thinks about, oh, if I could just go back, you know, 30 minutes, you know, and not made a fool out of myself, you know, or if I could go to the future and see, like, what's going to happen to me? Like, what am I going to look like 10 years from now? Am I going to have the same job? It's just human nature to think about those questions. And I think that's what got me into time travel.
And what did you find about our portrayal of time travel in culture, popular culture, and also, you know, all kinds of culture, art, religion, and science? How long has this been with us?
Yeah, well, it's funny because a lot of people don't realize how long time travel has been around. Like, one of the very first written texts in human history is the Mahabharata. It's this Hindu text, and that has time travel stories in it. And that was written in like 500 BC or so. But then with the Industrial Revolution, you know, H.G. Wells, the time machine, and it became this like sci-fi idea that we think of today.
Is there anything that some of these early, more traditional kinds of time travel myths and stories have in common? I mean, I'm talking about the stuff that comes before the H.G. Wells era.
Definitely. It's more like time travel sort of happens to the person. You know, it's just like this thing that randomly happened to the hero of the story. And most of them just go to a different realm in time. But as soon as H.G. Wells wrote The Time Machine, we got control of time.
So you also spoke to a number of scientists who you had assumed in your original idea for the film that the scientists would be very dismissive of this stuff. What did you discover in the folks that you talked to, the physicists, the computer scientists, mathematicians?
I got to speak to this one physicist, theoretical physicist. His name is Ron Mallett, and he is a professor at the University of Connecticut. And he's actually doing an experiment relating to time travel. He wants to take little particles and send them back in time.
Whoa. How far?
Milliseconds. Yeah, it's not like going back to like dinosaurs or anything. It's just a baby step.
But still, I mean, that's not supposed to be possible.
It sounds wild, but you know, when you think about it, in the laws of physics, it's theoretically possible to go forward in time, like with time dilation. The closer you are to the speed of light, the slower time is for you. So that's a way to time travel.
The physicist you mentioned, Professor Mallett from Connecticut, what motivates a guy like that?
When Ron Mallett was 10 years old, his father passed away from a heart attack. And
for me, it was like the death of Superman, because here was this person who seemed to me to be indestructible, and now he was gone. My world just fell completely apart. And about a year after he died, when I was 11, I came across H.G. Wells' book, The Time Machine. Actually, it was a Classics Illustrated version of that. It changed my life because at the very beginning of it said, scientific people know very well that time is just a kind of space, and we can move forward and backward in time just as we can in space. And when I read that, it was like, this is the answer for me. If I could build a time machine, then I could go back into the past and see him again and maybe change things. That became my saving. That was it. That was my life preserver. That was the thing that saved me.
He became a theoretical physicist, and now he's doing it. Like, he's, you know, raising funds to build this experiment for time travel.
Wow. Any other cool people that you talked to that would be worth highlighting?
So I got to speak to a jazz musician, Tamara Davidson, about the idea of time from a musical perspective or from an artist's perspective. She came across this really prolific jazz musician. His name's Sun Ra. He's an amazing character, and he has these really interesting philosophical ideas, but he basically believes that through music you can travel through time. Really trippy stuff. Like Afrofuturism, like very trippy. It's really cool.
So as you discovered all these different ways that time travel has bubbled up in our pop culture, in religion, in art. What did it lead you to think about, you know, what this is an expression of? Like, what is it about human nature that makes us gravitate toward it?
You know, at the center of every time travel story, I think, is love. Like, it's a love story. Like 12 Monkeys, like, you know, like Back to the Future. There's like some Peggy Sue got married. There's like a little story about love that's related to it. And I think it says a lot about us as human beings that, you know, that's why we're so interested in the topic.
Well, before I let you escape, Gisela, I'm going to ask you the question again. Let's change it around just a little bit. If you could travel back in time, when would you travel to and why?
Oh, gosh. I never thought about traveling back in time. Always forward. If I traveled back in time, I'd probably go somewhere really far back. I'd love to see the Inca culture, like in South America, somewhere like something totally crazy that you would never see. But then I'd have to come back. Like, there's no way that you're going to leave me there. And let me turn it to you. Where would you go in time?
I mean, it's tempting for me to say like 30 years in the future because I have little kids and I think it'd be fascinating to see what their lives would be like at the same age that I am. So I'll go with that. And that is a love story.
That was good. Yeah.
Well, Gisela Bustillos is a Seattle area filmmaker and her forthcoming documentary is called A Brief History of Time Travel. You can find out a whole bunch more about it at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Hey, Gisela, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Today we are thinking over the ticking clock, and this next story is about a standoff. It's almost operatic in its complexity and its drama. Here to tell us this story of marijuana on Capitol Hill is KPLU's Matthew Strive. Hey, Matthew.
Hi, Gabe.
So how does this start? What's the opening salvo in this weird little Cold War?
So earlier this year, Ian Eisenberg, who owns Uncle Ike's Pot Shop, bought the building of a veterinary office in Capitol Hill. He was in the middle of a court battle filed by a church which said his central district store was in violation of state distance rules for marijuana businesses because it was too close to a teen center. The building in Capitol Hill, however, was on this perfect corner, just over the 1,000-foot limit from daycare centers, parks, and other places that children hang out.
Okay, so this was going to be his kind of plan B. If he got kicked out of his central district store, or if there was some kind of legal problem there, he would have this thing to fall back on.
Yes, but the lawsuit from the church was dropped, so he never needed a contingency plan for that store. But he did, however, decide he wanted to have a second store. So he started working with Samuel Burke, an investment banker who had won the lottery for a marijuana license. But that deal fell apart. And then, when they split, Burke ended up renting space across the street from Eisenberg's potential new store, in the process displacing a cobbler. And then, the old veterinarian's office became something different.
And what is that, exactly?
That's the sound of me playing a 1980s arcade game. An arcade is what Eisenberg opened instead.
He was going to open a pot shop, and instead he opened an arcade.
Yes.
I was on vacation earlier this summer in Japan, and all my kids wanted to do was hang out in the arcades. And it kind of reminded me when I was a kid. I remember when I was, I don't know, 13 or 12, and I first discovered I could take the number 2 downtown and go to Third Avenue on my own and play video games. That was fun. Going to an arcade was a sense of freedom for a little kid.
Eisenberg said he had some arcade games lying around the house, and so he put them in a space on Capitol Hill. And now kids can go and play them every weekday evening for free.
Did you say they're playing them for free?
Yeah, for free. Eisenberg is basically losing money because he's paying rent on a space that he can't charge money for because he doesn't have a use permit.
So why is he doing this? And why does he have arcade games lying around, by the way? I'm you know, that always raises my antenna, I have to say.
He just said he had them lying around and then he bought a few more and put them in the space. But Gabe, did you know that game arcades are some of the few establishments that preclude a pot shop from opening?
Wait, what? Why would that be?
Well, here's what the state statute says. Quote, The State Liquor and Cannabis Board shall not issue a license for any premises within 1,000 feet of the perimeter of the grounds of any elementary or secondary school, playground, recreation center or facility, child care center, public park, public transit center or library, or any game arcade admission to which is not restricted to persons aged 21 years or older.
Ah, okay. So Uncle Ike opened this arcade to keep his former partner, current rival, from opening the pot shop across the street.
Well, that's not what he told me. He told me it was just a coincidence. But now, Burke's shop across the street has been in this limbo of opening and not opening for months. And Burke declined 3 times to talk with me about this piece. But Burke's representatives have said publicly before that Eisenberg is anti-competitive and trying to squeeze them out.
Huh. So does it seem like he's going to succeed in squeezing them out?
Well, I'm not sure. I talked with Mikhail Carpenter, a spokesman for the State Liquor and Cannabis Board. He said the arcade may not keep the competition from opening because the city can decide that the arcade is not really an arcade and Burke can open anyway.
Wait, well, you were playing a 1980s video game. That is about as arcadey a thing as I can think of. How could this be not an arcade?
Well, it's because when they were doing the referendum, an arcade was not legally defined. And so it's up to the city to decide whether or not this arcade is an arcade. What I do know is that Eisenberg still wants to make his arcade into a pot shop, but he won't be able to do so until more marijuana licenses are released.
All right. Well, that's a fascinating and strange story of an arcade that may not just be an arcade after all. Hey, thanks, Matthew, for bringing this story.
Wait, Gabe. I'm not done yet. It gets even more intricate.
Oh, my. This has got more twists, more turns.
That's the sound of a sewing machine from the 1800s. It belongs to a man named Ray Angel. Remember how Burke bought out the lease of the cobbler across the street? That's Angel.
Oh, yeah, the displaced cobbler.
Yeah, and the neighborhood was not happy that he was evicted.
Angel really reminded me of, like, an Andy Griffith community.
Any day of the week, people from the neighborhood are just standing outside chatting with Angel, not because they're coming by to get their shoes fixed or get a key burnt, but because Angel's their friend.
He's got too many roots as far as relationships to not be a fixture. It'd be hard to imagine 15th without Angel.
Angel is a 67-year-old cobbler whose family has been repairing shoes in Seattle for 103 years. He had to leave his old location because Burke made an offer on the rent that he couldn't match. Angel still doesn't have enough money to retire, and because of that, he was trying to negotiate a deal to work in Burke's pot shop to make enough money to get by.
So wait, he was going to be the pot cobbler? How does he go from repairing shoes to working in the pot shop?
He wanted to be a security guard, 20 hours a week for 3 years, guaranteed pay. But that all fell apart.
I was scared. I was in tears a lot, to be honestly truthful. I don't make enough money to survive without a job. I'm at that point where at least I've got a little Social Security to back me up, and I can slow down a bit, take a little bit more time off. I haven't taken it easy in a long time.
Oh, wow, that's really kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah, it kind of is. But this month, a sign went up to signal that Angel is opening again. Guess where?
I'm on the edge of my seat. Where?
In the same building as Eisenberg's arcade.
I thought long-term, the combination of a pot shop with the cobbler on the side, I mean, it's a nice fit, and everybody loves him there.
And why is Uncle Ike doing this?
He said he felt bad for Angel, but Angel said he didn't even know he was being offered retail space in Eisenberg's building until he read about it in the Capitol Hill Seattle blog.
Jeez. Okay, so it seems like this could at least work out for Angel, if nobody else, right?
Kind of. Right now, he still has no income because customers can't get in. You see, his shop doesn't have a door.
That does seem like a problem for a walk-in business. How does he not have a door?
Well, Angel's space is in the corner of the building, and from the street, it's just a brick wall. He's waiting for the city to issue construction permits.
Okay, so the clock is ticking for Angel the cobbler. What about all this other craziness? When does it all end?
In a year, maybe? Burke needs the city to decide if the arcade's really an arcade. Eisenberg needs permits to finish work on his space and a second license to open up a marijuana store. And Angel needs a door.
Good Lord. All right, well, we will be watching KPLU's Matthew Stribe. Thanks so much, Matthew.
You're welcome, Gabe.
Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwin Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad. We had contributions this week from producer Matthew Strybe and intern Bree Ripley. Web help from Mike Lewis. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. And a special shout out this week to our dear friend of the show, John Nix. We are, of course, on iTunes. Subscribe to our podcast there. And it's super helpful to us if you can write us a short review. I think that Arwin's offer from last week still stands, that she will write you a personalized thank you note if you can do that. Meanwhile, you can also send feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org or tweet at KPLU and at Gabriel Spitzer. Come on back next week when we will hear tales of theft.
Oh no, it was kind of romantic. Bank robbery has sort of a romanticism relationship with this country.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.